And that Justice Castle will be participating on the briefs in this case. Mr. Wilson, good morning to you. You may approach.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Mike Wilson. I represent the appellant in this matter, Michael Dugan. This is an interesting one. I don't know if it's as interesting as your last one, but I think it's interesting as well. To what extent, this is the question I believe that our assignment of error presents here. To what extent is this court willing to surrender its jurisdiction, district courts, that summarily determine a party's notice of appeal is a mere annoyance? That's a restatement of our assignment of error, but I really feel as though that sort of crystallizes the issue that we're presenting here. And the court, this court, must act here in this case to protect its jurisdiction going forward.
Counsel, isn't there case law that, presently district judges use that if there's just multiple appeals that the court can find that it's not a final order to proceed to trial? Hasn't that issue already been decided?
There are cases in which, I mean, essentially that it's a frivolous appeal, and there's public policy that would favor some sort of rule stating that if a defendant, a criminal defendant in particular, is bringing multiple appeals in some attempt to delay trial, you know, cause problems for the state, that sort of thing, that, you know, there might be a case in which a district court would summarily deny the appeal or deny a request to stay the proceedings while that appeal pends and proceed to trial. I'm not arguing that there's never going to be a circumstance in which that's appropriate. But what I am arguing is that the court, the district court, has an obligation. It has an obligation to analyze the issues that are being presented in the motions that are being appealed. And it has an obligation to determine whether there's any application of either, whether it be the final appealable order under Big John's Billiards sets out a few different types, special proceeding one, which we've argued would apply in this case. But then there's also this court's opinion in State v. Jackson, and then also in followed up with Williams v. Baird. These are cases which explore the collateral order doctrine. And I'm arguing primarily in favor of the application of those precedents in this case.
But there is no longer a collateral order doctrine in Nebraska, correct?
Well, I'd argue that under Jackson, and if you look at, for instance, Williams, and then ultimately under Big John's Billiards, that's still in place. If you apply the reasoning from these cases, what you have here at a minimum is a special proceeding. And if you...
Well, that's different than collateral order, though. Because just a month ago, didn't we say there is no collateral order in Nebraska?
All right. There was a case that came down pretty recently.
Correct.
And I'd like to try to distinguish it from that case if I can, but I'd also like to argue in favor of application of Big John's Bill.
Well,
the special proceeding.
You're getting... You had the charges pending, and you had a request for reduction of bail. That was denied, and you took an appeal from that. And then you also then had a motion that you made for absolute discharge, and you took an appeal from that. And the trial court didn't do anything other than deny your motion for absolute discharge based upon your allegedly unlawful warrant arrest and extradition back to the state of Nebraska from Cheyenne. The trial continues on, and these two appeals are pending. That's the factual scenario. All right. So your arguments are that when you took those appeals, the trial court no longer had jurisdiction.
That's the
court. And the question then is whether or not these appeals were final and appealable orders from which an appeal could be taken. In order to determine that on the excessive bail issue, you have to overrule State versus Kula, and State versus Kula says an appeal on excessive bail is not a final appealable order. And then the question becomes, is your motion for absolute discharge based upon the alleged wrongful arrest and extradition a final appealable order? And that's really the question in front of us, isn't it?
Yeah, well...
Well, and why is that a final appealable order that would divest the court from jurisdiction and therefore void the conviction and trial because it didn't have jurisdiction at the time because the appeal was pending?
Specific to the illegal extradition?
But then you come. Then we have another problem that comes into that, is that you voluntarily dismissed that appeal to the court.
Okay, I'll start with that, if that's okay.
Sure.
I'd argue that that subsequent dismissal by the agreement of the parties had zero effect on the determination of whether the Court of Appeals ever had jurisdiction at the time of the trial.
But you argue that the order was collateral, or was a collateral order, don't you? And the stipulation, doesn't it say that this was a... Or no, you said interlocutory.
Right, and that word, I'd also argue, is immaterial, because that word doesn't necessarily mean that a Court of Appeals doesn't have jurisdiction.
It doesn't necessarily mean that this appeal isn't a final order, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and so that part of it, that second part of what you said, I just basically argue just okay. Isn't really relevant to the determination. Now, with respect to the illegal extradition, and I know you called it an alleged, I think we made a pretty good prima facie showing at the time of the motions that were made to the trial court. I know it was called a motion for absolute discharge, by the way. Clearly absolute discharge wasn't
okay.
Warranted under any circumstances.
And what happened in that case was the party was arrested before the warrant had been issued. So he was in custody before the warrant was issued.
In our case, right?
Your case. Yeah,
yeah, in our case.
And then he waives extradition and comes back to Nebraska.
No, in our case, he never had a hearing.
He had to have some way to come back when he signed
it. They brought him back illegally.
You're saying he didn't waive extradition?
There were several documents introduced that were improper. They weren't notarized properly. The signatures were mismatched. There was a big problem here in this extradition.
What
We don't have to debate that too much.
What does that have to do with the authority of the court once it has the defendant in front of it in and has jurisdiction over the defendant to proceed with the trial, regardless of how the defendant got there?
There are Fourth Amendment rights, 14th Amendment rights, implicated by an illegal extradition. So if those rights are not at any time if the defendant cannot bring a challenge to an illegal extradition at some time prior to a trial, because after trial, we can't address the illegal extradition after trial.
Well, would you have a remedy for writ of habeas corpus if you filed it timely?
Yes.
But you didn't timely file it.
Filed a writ of habeas corpus.
Before the trial?
Yes. He filed one in federal court and he presented that to the trial court. And that's really where...
And what happened in federal court?
Well, in federal court, eventually, I believe that was dismissed, but it was still pending at the time of trial.
After the conviction and sentence, the trial court.
Right.
The federal court dismissed the writ.
Exactly. Eventually, it was, yes, but that would have been after trial. I'd like to reserve about 2 minutes, if I could, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning to you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. Your Honors, we're here on the denial of a defendant's motion for habeas corpus relief, which kind of takes it out of the realm of the usual appeal. Habeas corpus relief is justified only where the court lacks either personal or subject matter jurisdiction. In this case, the district court had both, and so the habeas was properly denied. Dugan is essentially kind of claiming both personal and subject matter jurisdiction problems, more subject matter, I think, at this point in time than personal jurisdiction. The personal jurisdiction issue is essentially resolved, I think, by Frisbee versus Collins, which says that if the defendant is brought before the court, it doesn't really matter how he got there. If he's there, he's there, and the court has personal jurisdiction over him. Subject matter jurisdiction problem arises out of the multiple appeals that the defendant attempted to take as a result of rulings that didn't go his way. The last one was essentially the one, he filed it on the day that trial was to begin, literally the day that trial was to begin, and that was his motion for discharge based on the fact that he was, that there were problems with his, the process by which Nebraska brought him back for a trial on the charges.
What are those steps? He was arrested before the warrant was issued.
That's my understanding.
And then how did he get back to Nebraska? Did he, would he have to waive extradition?
I would assume so. The record isn't, at least that we've got right now, isn't real clear. I think it would have been in some of the prior cases, and frankly, I don't have those facts right at hand. But,
what's his remedy then if he's arrested before the warrant is issued and then brought back to Nebraska at that point in time? What's his remedy?
At that point in time, his remedy probably would have been a petition for writ of habeas corpus. Now, that probably wouldn't have affected the criminal charges, because they can essentially run parallel, I would say, to each other without stepping on each other's toes. And because the one doesn't necessarily, he's not going to get dismissal of the charges as a result, probably, of the illegality or issues with his return to the state of Nebraska.
Well, what would a writ of habeas corpus do for the defendant when he's now being held in jail and being tried, and the trial is proceeding? What remedy would he, what would the habeas corpus do?
The habeas corpus actually, it would direct the court to release him. It doesn't mean that he is discharged from the trial or from the charges. It's simply an order to release him.
And then the court could then order an arrest warrant for him and be put back in jail again?
Yes. It could.
So he doesn't have much of a remedy on his claim.
I beg your pardon, the conviction stays in your view?
Yes. Yes.
Because the district court properly has jurisdiction to hear the case, and the defendant is in custody or is in front of the court, and the trial proceeds.
Correct.
And then once the trial proceeds, does he have any remedies after that?
State versus Herrig, which is a 1974 case, I think I inadvertently did not cite that, but I'll give you the citation to it. It is 192 Nebraska 49, a 1974 case, very clearly says the issue of it's a pretrial bail, but it's not, his release is not appropriate after essentially the conviction is.
Well, once his conviction or sentence, he's been convicted and sentenced, then he has, his only remedy now is to appeal from the conviction and sentence.
Correct. It's a direct appeal.
And that gives the review by the appellate court.
Correct.
The trial. Does the appellate court consider any of those issues with regard to whether or not the trial court had jurisdiction based upon his alleged appeals that were made before the trial commenced?
I would think that jurisdiction would always be at least a potential issue. I think as in the course of the way this particular...
Did the Court of Appeals address any claims of lack of jurisdiction on direct appeal?
On direct appeal, my recollection is it did not. I would have
Were they raised? Or
I don't believe they were raised. I don't believe they were raised.
Was it summarily affirmed?
I believe it was summarily affirmed.
Okay.
That's my recollection of it. So I would think that jurisdiction would not have been raised if it were going to be summarily affirmed, or if it was raised, it was so clearly without merit that there was nothing to talk about.
Certainly if you take a direct appeal and your argument is that the trial court didn't have jurisdiction over me, that would have to be an issue that you'd have to raise on direct appeal, wouldn't it?
I think so.
And if you don't raise it on direct appeal, then what's the result?
Then it's procedurally barred, because that would be your first opportunity to raise it. The issue was apparently clearly available to have been raised, and it would be procedurally barred at later proceedings.
So in this case, is there any argument that trial counsel was ineffective?
I think that, I don't know, that's probably an allegation that could be made, but that's basically another story for another day. I think just going through a real fast mental analysis of it, I think he would probably, the claim could be raised, but I think it would ultimately be fruitless because as this whole thing shook out.
But it's not in front of us in this.
It's not in front of us, no. At this point in time, it's not, no. Your Honors, I think pretty much everything has been said that needs to be said. If there are additional questions, I'd be happy to address them. If not, we would ask that the denial of habeas relief be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal?
1 minute and 48
seconds, Mr. Wilson.
In response to Your Honor's questions about whether this was addressed on direct appeal following the conviction, it was addressed. A-08-063, Court of Appeals considered the assignment of error that Dugan, that the trial court erred in finding that he was properly extradited from Wyoming and failing to grant his motion to dismiss based upon unlawful seizure from Wyoming and unlawful return to Nebraska. So that was considered, if that answers your question.
That goes to, seems to me that goes to trial error, but doesn't go to the jurisdiction.
Right, which is exactly why we're bringing this now in a habeas petition. If you don't allow him to litigate that issue out prior to trial, it basically you're finding that you're rendering the Uniform Criminal Extradition Act toothless. Where else is he supposed to litigate the fact that he was brought here illegally? He can't.
Counsel, your client could have been, let's say the habeas is granted. Habeas doesn't go to jurisdiction, it goes to unlawful custody. So the remedy, let's say the judge said, okay, I agree. The judge could have just released him on no bond and gave him a trial date. And then your client would have to appear for trial or be subject to another warrant. But the remedy is only custody, not jurisdiction, right?
That's true to an extent, yes. But the fact that he's in a different state when he's arrested, he had a right to a probable cause determination in that state, in the courts of that state, by a judge of that state.
Right, but we don't review what another state does. We have to review the procedures in this state, don't we? I mean, we can't tell another state what to do and not do.
Yes, we review the procedures of this state, but the procedure of this state in this case was to illegally remove him.
Okay, but again, even if he was, let's say hypothetically he was, the only remedy is release from custody. It's not jurisdictional, is my point.
Well, that may be the case. And if you're right, right about that, I don't think that ends the discussion, because what we did was we appealed that, and immediately upon that appeal, that conferred jurisdiction upon the Court of Appeals to determine that very question.
Then the best case scenario is you'd get a new trial, you wouldn't get discharged. Because the court shouldn't have tried him, that's still not jurisdictional.
Well, the court, if it's trying a person, the district court is trying a person while the Court of Appeals is exercising its exclusive jurisdiction. That is a problem.
But we're getting beyond the scope of what we're being presented here, and that is you're attacking the judgment of sentence and conviction as being void.
Correct.
Because the trial court did not have jurisdiction because there were two appeals pending.
There was an appeal.
Your appeal from the failure to reduce the bond, and your appeal from the failure to grant an absolute discharge based upon the arrest in Wyoming and transportation to Sydney for trial.
There was an appeal pending in the Court of Appeals from the orders denying him the right to litigate those issues out.
Well, the question still remains is whether or not those appeals were final orders that could divest the trial court of jurisdiction until those appeals were resolved. And that's what's presented in front of this court today and nothing else.
Whether they were reviewable orders. I don't always love the term final orders because I think
we've got concerns with interlocutory orders, and
right.
If they're not final and appealable, they don't divest the trial court of jurisdiction, even though you may want some relief and determination. But if you can't request that relief during the trial or before the trial by virtue of an appeal to a higher court, that doesn't necessarily divest the court of jurisdiction if those appeals are not final orders.
I'm not going to argue that point with you specifically, but okay. What I am going to suggest is that the term final orders, mm-hmm. if you exclude anything that's reviewable, you know what I mean? Because there are reviewable orders that might not fall under the very first section of the first category in Big John's Billiards. All right, there are other ones. And so those orders, if they come from a special proceeding, that sort of thing, in which I argue this was because we were trying to do a collateral appeal or a collateral, you know, review of the issues that are at stake here, which were excessive bail and illegal extradition.
Well, and you would concede that you can't get this as a final order on the basis of excessive bail unless we change our opinion in Kula.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So
yeah,
you're really focusing on whether or not there was a final appeal order from your motion for absolute discharge.
Yeah, I think, again, I worry about the term final order because to me it's semantics. The question.
Well,
is,
we're concerned about whether the trial court's been divested by jurisdiction by the motion that you filed, whatever we call it.
Yeah, right. And that's what I want the court to look at. Mm-hmm. I want the court to determine, okay, regardless of what the outcome would have been in the Court of Appeals, did that notice of appeal of those orders confer jurisdiction? That's important because the trial court is violating its jurisdictional statutes by proceeding with trial while there's a docket pending in the Court of Appeals.
If it's
reviewable.
If it's a reviewable order that divests the court from jurisdiction.
Correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.